Welcome to these Bible lessons on the Old Testament. In these lessons, we'll cover God's magnificent creation of all the world, including the creation of man, the crown of God's creation. We'll follow with the sad fall of man in paradise and the consequences this brought to the world. In the continuing lessons, we'll teach how God visits men with the revelation of His covenant of grace. When we travel together through the entire Old Testament, we see God visiting His nation of Israel with revelations of this covenant of grace, pointing constantly to the coming Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. We hope these lessons are a blessing to you. Thank you.
It is the year 445 BC. A lot has transpired in Israel and Judah since their captivity. You recall that the Assyrians finally conquered Israel, the northern kingdom, in 722 BC, taking many of the inhabitants captive. God used the Assyrians to punish Israel for their sins, especially for their sin of idolatry. Judah, the southern kingdom, was also guilty, especially for its apostasy. When Judah saw Israel being conquered, the inhabitants may have thought they were better and maybe even untouchable because a century later, they were still undefeated. But in 586 BC, it was God's time. He used the Babylonians to punish Judah, and they destroyed the temple as well as the city of Jerusalem. The rulers, the rich, the educated were all taken captive. Many of the inhabitants of Jerusalem were killed in the conquest. The poor were left to take care of the land. You learned in the last few lessons that God inclined the heart of Cyrus the king not only to allow, but also to decree that the Jewish people could return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. The prophets had foretold that God would be faithful to His covenant and not utterly forsake His people. And that is why in 536 BC, under the leadership of Zerubbabel, the first group of Jews returned to Jerusalem. More Jews returned with Ezra in 458 BC. Now, it is almost a century later. The Persian king Artaxerxes is still reigning. He was actually Esther's stepson. Artaxerxes, like most kings, had a person employed to be a cupbearer. A cupbearer was a high-ranking royal official. This person was primarily in charge of serving wine to the king. This may not seem very important, but this involved more than just acting as a butler or a waiter. The cupbearer was someone who had to make sure no one was attempting to poison the king, so he would have to taste the wine before he gave it to the king. This was someone whom the king trusted completely, and who had to be a man of irreproachable loyalty, capable of winning the king's complete confidence. For Artaxerxes, this man was Nehemiah. We do not know a lot about Nehemiah. We read that his father was Hakaliah, but we do not know what tribe he belonged to, or really anything else about him. He is the author of the book of Nehemiah, which opens during the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign. Nehemiah is serving in Shushan, the palace of the king of Persia. This is, by the way, the same palace where Esther served as queen. We will cover that history in a later lesson. Nehemiah receives a visit from Hanani and a few other men from Jerusalem. Part of their discussion is about those who returned to Jerusalem earlier from the captivity. Nehemiah wants to know how they are doing and the response is far from encouraging. This is what they say. The remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. What does this mean? Well, even though the majority of them had been in Jerusalem now for around 15 years, they were still considered outsiders or foreigners by the original inhabitants. They simply were not welcome. So there was general contempt for them. Furthermore, the destruction left by the Babylonians in 586 BC was still there. They had rebuilt the temple, but the city walls and the special gates were still in ruins. This news deeply affects Nehemiah. He sits down and weeps. For several days, he cries about the condition of Israel, and at the same time, he fasts. Finally, he prays to God. You can read his prayer in verses 5 through 11 in chapter 1. Notice the reverence and awe he has for God, and pay close attention to how he confesses the sins of the people and his pleading for God's mercy. He pleads on God's covenant mercy. He reminds God, humanly speaking, of the promises God has made to the nation of Israel. He also asks God to have the king be willing to help him. Chapter 2 opens with, "And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence." Why is Nehemiah pointing out that he had never been sad in the king's presence before? Well, it is believed that he was not allowed to be sad as cupbearer. He had a very important position that required a cheerful countenance. Some think that there could have been some punishment or discipline as a result of not being or appearing happy. But Nehemiah is not able to hide his grief or sadness, and the king notices it. Verse 2 reads, "Wherefore the king said unto me, Why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart." I want to read an excerpt from one commentary on this passage. It reads as follows. "His kindly question, put by the great king to his humble retainer, is his best claim to the favorable judgment of later ages. History puts him before us as a weak monarch, one who could compromise the royal dignity by making terms with a revolted subject, while he disgraced it by breaking faith with a conquered enemy. But if weak as king, as a man, he was kind-hearted and gentle. Few Persian monarchs would have been sufficiently interested in their attendants to notice whether they were sad or no. Fewer still would have shown sympathy on such an occasion. Artaxerxes might have ordered the culprit to instant execution. The king feels compassion and wishes to assuage the grief of his servant. Then I was sore afraid, says Nehemiah. Notwithstanding the king's kind and compassionate words, Nehemiah feels his danger. He has looked sad in the king's presence. He is about to ask permission to leave the court. These are both sins against the fundamental doctrine of Persian court life, that to bask in the light of the royal countenance is the height of felicity. Will the king be displeased, refuse his request, dismiss him from his post, cast him into prison, or will he pardon his rudeness and allow his request? Thus ends the quote from the commentary. Nehemiah tells the king what is on his heart. He tells him about Jerusalem and how it still lies in ruins. The king asks him what Nehemiah is requesting. Nehemiah raises a silent prayer unto the Lord. We are not told what he prayed, but we can well imagine he prayed for wisdom to know what to say to the king. He probably also prayed that the king's heart would be inclined to respond kindly to his requests. He asks if he may return to Jerusalem to rebuild it. Remarkably, the king does not become angry. No, the king simply wants to know how long he would have to be gone. Nehemiah also asks for letters that will prove that he has a right to be there and to travel, and a letter so that he will be able to obtain the necessary wood to repair the palace, the gates, and the walls of the city. Doesn't this seem a little bold and audacious? How does he dare ask these things? Will the king become angry and dismiss him from his position and imprison him or possibly even execute him? No. Nehemiah's God is a faithful God, a powerful God who directs all things. We read, "And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me." Nehemiah safely arrives in Jerusalem eventually, but not everyone is happy to see him. There are two men in particular, Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, who are extremely bothered that someone is coming to help the Israelites. These men are not Jewish and want nothing to do with the true worship with the Jews. We will see the problems they created a bit later in our study. Nehemiah takes some time to assess the damage one night, but he does not tell anyone what his plans are yet. He visits the various gates and he surveys the walls of the city. Finally, he shares his findings and his plan. They must rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. So they begin to prepare for this task, and it does not go unnoticed. At the end of chapter 2, we read, "But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king?' Then answered I them and said unto them, 'The God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem.'" They think, or they want others to think, that the motive is to secure Jerusalem so that they can rebel against the Persians. Obviously, this was not the case. When you read chapter 3 for yourselves, you might ask yourself or find yourself asking why such a detailed description is given of the repairs and the names of those who did them. First of all, this demonstrates the historical nature of the record. These events actually occurred, and the work was done by real people who actually existed. Second, it shows the meticulous organization of the work, and it also gives us an idea of what a huge project this must have been. Finally, it reminds us of how important it is to give credit where credit is due. There are many practical lessons that we can learn from these first three chapters. Here are a few. First, we can see how important it is to inquire about the welfare of others in our church community, especially the spiritual welfare. We also should be aware of what is happening to other Christians throughout the world, those who are persecuted, those who are victims of natural disasters, etc. We should lay their needs before the Lord in prayer. Second, we should consider what our service to God is. What can we do in God's kingdom to help? We need to pray for insight and wisdom for this as well. And third, we are to use the means. Can we use our leaders for the benefit of the church? Do we ever prayerfully ask God to incline the hearts of our leaders to have a favorable view toward Christians and Christianity in general? And finally, we need an organized plan. Nehemiah did not simply go to work. Every step of the way was planned, from asking Artaxerxes if he could leave Shushan to the actual work of rebuilding. Now, we are not all going to be like Nehemiah, but we should try to use whatever talents God has given us to His name's honor and glory for the extension of His glorious kingdom.